Could you introduce yourself first?
Sure. Sego Amanda Yunjit, Ya Dewaga Daryander, Ya Dewaga Daryanderde, Tsini Waksa Noda, Nopohoe Neha, Deno Ginyodo, Nandawaga Hodinishoni. So I said hello, and I go by Amanda, but I don't know my indigenous name, and I'm of the Turtle Clan of the Onondaga Nation of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, or the Seneca Haudenosaunee.
So I invite you to do this interview to talk about decolonization and also the context of the opposition to Line 9. So could you begin by introducing what is decolonization in your point of view?
In my point of view, decolonization is the process of trying to heal the trauma of colonialism and actually literally like dismantle the infrastructure of colonization and capitalism. Because I think that capitalism and colonization are very intimately tied systems, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that more later. But so decolonization is a physical, emotional, spiritual process that is cultural as well as individual. And so for me, I'm trying to focus on food security and language acquisition in an indigenous context in order to like further my process of decolonization. But I also think that doing things like physically disrupting the infrastructure of colonial capitalism is also part of a praxis of decolonization, and actually like physically dismantling the concrete jungle is helpful. And yeah, so I hope that's good if you have any questions. I think that decolonization looks really different for a lot of different people as well, and it depends on who you are and where you are, because like an understanding of colonialism informs a process of decolonization, and so how colonization manifests in different territories is totally different. For instance, like, but there's a lot of parallels, like colonization in Africa versus colonization in Turtle Island. There's a lot of parallels, but they happened in different ways. And so it's really important to ground yourself in an understanding of the occupied and stolen territories that you are on, and trying to align yourself with local struggles in that sense, and like aligning oneself with indigenous struggle. And so part of that too is to understand the role of the settler colonial state and like the systemic and systematic disenfranchisement of indigenous peoples from their territories and homelands. And
And you've been talking about activities like learning language and also growing food or plants. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about how you feel that's connected with decolonization?
Well, that's a very intimate question for me. As a Haudenosaunee person, the foods that I'm growing, the seeds, they're Jinhekwa, the three sisters, are life sustainers, and they're corn, beans, and squash. These are all, they're Haudenosaunee seeds, they're indigenous seeds, and they have no GMOs. So they're ancient, like, heirloom seeds, and they're very hard to come by. I had to travel to south of the colonial border in some cases, and in other cases, going to like different Haudenosaunee communities across the provincial border as well, between so-called Ontario and so-called Quebec. And so the thing is, like, in my cultural tradition, the role of the three sisters is, like, they are called the life sustainers, Jinhekwa, which is the Ganyagahaga word for them. And so for me, we cannot have a sovereign and nationhood if we do not have a way to sustain ourselves. And it's very important, I think, for us in our process of decolonization to heal our relationships with the land, to begin to grow food again, and to create that connection between humanity and that which sustains us. Because we have a responsibility as beings on this earth to go forth in a good way and just not to do the things that we see in capitalism. And so I think that we will be closer to remembering our original instructions and why we are here. If we have a relationship with the land and being able to understand where our food comes from, it's huge. It's a big part of that. And there's a lot of stories wrapped up in the seeds. And there's a lot of spiritual memory, I think, like blood memory and intergenerational communication that happens. I feel it's very powerful to have Onkohome seeds and to know that my ancestors and even those just like a few generations before me had planted them. And there's like folks who've been working really hard for like decades to try to source like indigenous seeds and especially Haudenosaunee seeds and try to create a catalog to understand what ones still exist, because our biodiversity has been really negatively impacted by things like genetically modified corn and monoculture and like agribusiness. And so, and like language, I can't even begin to unpack that because I'm still really learning, but it's a totally different mindset. How I think, like how I perceive things, stories, and the cultural knowledge that is embedded in language is absolutely phenomenal. And the insights that it provides are endless. In terms of revitalizing culture and nationhood, having fluent speakers and having food security are two incredible ways of like building community as well as rebuilding some of that lost information. Not necessarily lost, but that information has become disparate. Part of like the colonial agenda is to erase those histories, our rich histories. And so it's very important that we not only preserve them, but live them. And if we're going to ever try to like bust out of this colonial capitalist status quo, then we need to remember and relearn and relive those life ways and those teachings. And there's a lot of different ways of doing that. And so looking to carry forward those traditions like through planting seeds or like learning language, I think it's really important.
You've been talking also about dismantling the system of colonization and also the system of oppression in general. Can you talk about good example of struggles that are doing that or trying to do that?
I feel like right now there's a lot of interesting things kind of happening in the radical environmental movement where people are talking about anti-oppression a lot more thoroughly. And I think that it's really difficult. It's hard to say, is a movement doing this? I think, especially because I like organizing in affinity groups and like sometimes will form organizations and like have other alliances, but in terms of like movements that are really working towards like anti-oppressive praxis, I think that it's hard to say because it's really difficult work and it's really difficult to fully integrate our understandings of power through privilege and oppression into our day-to-day lives. And we never reach a threshold where we're able to, you know, say that like we've done it, we're now anti-oppressive. Like I think that is an ongoing work. And it's also part of like a healing process too, because the way that violence is used in our society, people like a lot of time will talk about like nonviolence and like let's be nonviolent, let's be peaceful. But I think that that invisibilizes or like contributes to the invisibilization of the violence that makes up the very framework of our society. And so understanding that we live in an incredibly violent time, and that the way that we are socialized is under a regime of violence, then there's a lot of healing to be had, and it's deep. It's really deep how far things go. But I don't know, I feel like there are definitely folks who have intersectional analyses and like are working towards that kind of stuff. Like I know that like Queen Fasheen seems to be pretty solid. I mean, I haven't met her in real life, but from what I can see of her writing and stuff, she seems to have a really great intersectional analysis. And I know that like the cis white pet boys at Earth First are really trying. I want to say also that like folks who are involved in like the Chemical Valley anti-pipeline gathering that just happened in Sarnia, but like Omgenog territories about 2 months ago, and a lot of the folks who are working on the Line 9 campaign are really trying to center anti-oppression as part of our liberation. And I think that it's really important for us to do that in order to build a stronger movement, as well as to not like reproduce that same kind of violence. And so for me on a local level, I feel like, you know, in my very community, like the Center for Gender and Social Justice, for instance, like is a really awesome organization that like is a feminist organization, but it like uses a intersectional analysis. And so like incorporating like trans inclusion, anti-racism, decolonization, and like things like this. And then like down on a regional level, like No Line 9. And I feel like it's just something that's like ongoing.
Are you placing the struggle against Line 9 in the context of work or a struggle in the sense of decolonization?
Again, like coming from a Haudenosaunee perspective, it's a really big deal. It's a really, really big deal because Line 9, it stretches all the way from Omgenong to Gunasatage, like from Sarnia to Montreal. So how I understand my responsibilities like as an Ongwahome person means that like there are things that have come before me and I need to like honor some of those agreements, as well as I have relationships with the water, with the land, you know, with my community, and I have responsibilities to those relationships to ensure that to walk a life-affirming path for future generations, but not just for future generations, but for even all nations, like non-human and human nations, who are present now. And so for me, how I like have been feeling a lot of sense of urgency around Line 9, and especially around like building stronger alliances between like Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe peoples, whose territories are shared amongst the Great Lake region, particularly Lake Ontario. The way that that's informed for me is the Sewa Dogwa Sera, which is the Dish with One Spoon Wampum, which is one of the oldest agreements amongst Northeastern Indigenous peoples, and it includes the Anishinaabe and the Haudenosaunee. And so the Anishinaabe people, they talk about this agreement, they talk about this wampum treaty as a dish, and like some of the philosophy behind that is that we eat from a shared dish, and so we can look at the waters and these shared hunting grounds as like a place where we understand that both the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe are going to be eating from this dish, but also that non-human nations are going to be eating from this dish as well. And so, you know, the idea is sort of like respect there. And then the Haudenosaunee, like the word Sewa Dogwa Sera, just means the spoon. And so these two like autonomous nations have like, I mean, this is sort of how far our levels of self-determination and respect went for each other, is that we use different words and different concepts as analogies to explain how these treaty agreements, which were shared understandings, functioned. So I find that really interesting. But anyway, so the spoon with the Haudenosaunee, because we are governed by the Great Law of Peace. And so because the Anishinaabe are our brothers, there's like no knives at the table because knives cut. And we don't want to damage our relations. And also, we're going to share, the symbolism behind the spoon is mutual aid, in that we will share with each other, share nourishment. And so the idea is, like, if for some reason there was like a bad harvesting season and either nation was like low on food reserves and things like this, that we could ask each other for help in times when we needed assistance. And so this agreement between the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe is not only about taking care of each other, but also of taking care of these particular territories that Line 9 runs through. And so Line 9 is like a perfect example of corporate colonialism and the collaboration between the state and capitalism, where we see the ongoing commodification of like our deemed as natural resources, but what is like, you know, our mother, the earth. And we see like an ongoing assault on Indigenous nationhood and survival by virtue of like the ongoing contamination of homelands, and further to that, like the lack of free, prior, informed consent, which is the primary sort of statement by pretty much every Indigenous nation, you know, the band councils that are applying to the National Energy Board to say no to Line 9. Everyone's saying that they have had no consultation and that there's been very little consultation. And so it's like an ongoing assault on Indigenous nationhood, because when you remove Indigenous peoples from their lands, like you disconnect, because we are the land, you know, like that's what indigeneity is about coming from a particular place and having particular culture, a cultural relationships to the places that you're from. And so it just sort of encourages the further displacement of Indigenous peoples, and it directly threatens the health of these territories, especially in terms of water, because Line 9 runs through I don't know how many fucking watersheds all the way. Like, it's just the dumbest fucking thing I've ever seen in my life. You look at the map, and it's like a fucking crude oil, heavy crude oil pipeline that they want to run diluted bitumen through, which is an experimental tar sands product, and they're going to run it through it at higher temperatures and higher pressures, an extremely corrosive 40-year-old pipeline right beside Lake Ontario. Like, I mean, it's just fucking stupid. It's suicidal. It's absolutely suicidal. It's like, let's just fucking throw it directly into our water supply. Like, why not? Like, it's the largest fresh water supply on the earth, but hey, fuck it. You know? Yeah, so, I mean, especially too, because it's a tar sands product, right? And like, tar sands are like understood to be slow industrial genocide, the way that the folks up in like Fort Chip and Fort Mac, the impacts on the First Nations communities out there are horrendous, you know. And this thing called environmental racism, when Indigenous people and people of color are disproportionately impacted by environmental contamination, it's no accident in a white supremacist colonial system. And it's not going to be an accident in southern Ontario and in Quebec when spills happen and you go downstream and there's the Indigenous communities. I mean, one of the communities that's hit the most hard, and it's fucking devastating, the intensity of the poison over in Chemical Valley. But I gotta say that folks down in Omgenong are really resilient and they have really strong spirits, and the stuff that's happening there is really inspiring, and how their community is coming together to fight the tar sands and to mobilize each other. But I mean, right there, like Suncor, and there's all kinds of like intense, you know, industries, but there would be a refinery right there, and the diluted bitumen would be coming right through. So, I mean, it's a direct attack on sovereignty. It's a direct attack on people. It's like the ongoing colonization of Indigenous peoples. It is slow industrial genocide. It is part of the project of assimilation. It is the commodification of our Earth Mother. It is something that is pretty fucked up. And that's what was so inspiring, actually, about Swamp Line 9. Okay, I'm going to talk about that for a minute. Because they actually stopped that shit for like 7 days. I mean, it's not very long, but that's a long time at the same time, you know? I mean, 7 days is a blip, but they cost Enbridge a shit ton of fucking money, and I was actually really lucky to be able to go to the site. So they show up at like 7 a.m. or 6 a.m. or something like that, 7 days ago, and they walk up, and they just tell the workers to get the fuck out. They're just like, get the fuck out. This is stolen native land. Get the fuck out. We're shutting down your project. And the workers are like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? And then they're like, how about this? We're going to put our own locks on your gate, and you got 20 minutes to get the fuck out. And then they did. Then they finally left. They slapped their own locks down, set up a blockade, and halted construction at the Westover Terminal for 7 days. Line 9A is already approved from Sarnia to Westover. And then Line 9B, the National Energy Board hearings are going to be up late September, early October. But it's a rubber stamp process, and folks are strongly encouraged to think about alternative ways of resisting Line 9 in their communities that aren't the reification of a colonial system through the National Energy Board. So Westover Station was under construction. They were going through the last phases of the reversal of the Line 9A pipeline. So they're already starting the reversal of the pipeline. This shit is happening, and they're getting ready to begin the reversal on Line 9B because they anticipate being approved by the National Energy Board. And so the occupation, I mean, I was only there for the first night and the day, and then I left because I had to take care of some things, but it was really inspiring to see folks actually taking a stand and actually putting their bodies like literally on the line and like trying to disrupt business as usual and say no. And like, I really appreciated that they acknowledged the territories that they were on as stolen native land, their shared territories amongst the Shenanton, the Mississaugi Anishinaabe, and the Onondaga Haudenosaunee, which was my nation. So that was really inspiring, and everything was in consensus-style decision-making, which is great when you're trying to liaise with the police because no one can make decisions. And there was like a in-kind kitchen, and folks dropped off donations and food and stuff. The locals weren't too stoked. There was some yelling, go home, and stuff like this. But then later, this guy, he actually came back with coffee after having a couple sips of whiskey and apologized for yelling, and he felt bad, and he started supporting the blockade after. But the local residents were talking about how Enbridge was treating them really well, you know, their pockets kind of thing. So it was interesting that a lot of the people there weren't, like, the local people, the local settlers, were not stoked to see the blockade happening. But anyway, so it happened. It went on for 7 days, and this morning, or yesterday, across Canada, there was like 13 different demonstrations, so-called Canada, KK Canada. And like here where I live, we participated in Ngojwanong, or so-called Peterborough, Ontario. And I understand that so-called Montreal also had a demo today. So that was great to, like, you know, show support and make sure that there's like good momentum building. And because what happened was this morning at 7 a.m., there were police raids and 20 people were arrested. 15 of them got trespassing charges. The other four of which were physically blockaded to the Enbridge Gate. What did they? They got non-association with the rest, and they were charged with disobeying a court order and misdemeanor 5,000. And then the other person was an Anishinaabe organizer, and he was charged with breaking and entering, as well as, I think, trespassing. And so folks are still trying to, like, raise funds because there's going to be a number of tickets and there's actual criminal charges now. So people are trying to raise funds for legal costs. You could go to www.gofundme.com/swampline9 to make a donation on the internet. And you can also just check out their Twitter or their Facebook, swampline9, to stay updated. But, I mean, the most exciting part about the blockade was the fact that it was direct action that directly confronted and intervened with Enbridge's fucking plans. And Enbridge, they lost so much money. It prevented their products from getting to market on Monday. It's now Wednesday, you know, and they're behind. They're still behind. There was a crane removed from their property that was costing them. They were losing $500 an hour, minimum, just with this one crane not working. So, I mean, being able to hit their pockets is huge. And also, like I said, I think that it's always valuable to be disrupting and dismantling the actual physical infrastructure of capitalist colonialism. And so, like, props out to the Swampline 9 crew for that.
And if people want to keep informed about the struggles against Line 9 and also be informed in general about Line 9, how they can find information or available?
They could check out noline9.wordpress.com. And there's a list of organizations that are doing anti-Line 9 organizing. So just find out one that's near you and then send them an email and see how you can get involved, because there's some stuff coming up in Montreal. And so we're hoping to, like, build capacity in the Eastern Corridor to pull off some really excellent actions, you know, of our own, and show Enbridge what we're made of.
And what can be inspiring or informing people about decolonization? Specific books or sources of information in general?
There's one blog that I would say, if there's only one blog that you check out, it's a good one. Unsettlingamerica.wordpress.com. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff gets cross-posted into there. Stuff from Intercontinental Cry, the Decolonization Journal. It's a great appendix of a lot of content around decolonization, although it is mostly English, so there is a setback in that sense. But it is a really great piece of work. And obviously, you know, like Warrior Publications, ZigZag has a lot of really good resources out there for folks. Waz Yadawin, she's a Dakota scholar, was the co-editor of a decolonization handbook, and there's two of them, for Indigenous Eyes Only and for Indigenous Minds Only. So I would plug those as, like, places to start, you know, in terms of, like, the struggle in Turtle Island. And, yeah, I would just go for that for now.
Thanks.